Welcome to the All Souls Forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight's conversation with frequent forum presenter Dr. Tex Sample focuses on the provocative topic of white working class rage. The white working class have been credited with bringing Donald Trump into the White House, which to many progressives has been and continues to be a baffling and tragic turn of events. How did a billionaire from New York who inherited much of his wealth and status connect so strongly with people who seemingly have next to nothing in common with him? Dr. Sample suggests the answer lies in the nomenclature and identity of the white working class. Democrats ignore this to their peril as an important part of their historical constituency slips further and further away. From research gleaned while working on his forthcoming book, Dr. Sample will share ways he thinks urban progressives and the white working class can come together on issues important to them both. Dr. Sample is professor emeritus of the St. Paul School of Theology. He obtained his PhD from Boston University and his Doctor of Divinity from Coe College. He has published 13 books, including a bestseller entitled U.S. Lifestyles and Mainline Churches. Our show was recorded on September 22nd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. We begin with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Good morning. Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the forum committee. The forum's mission is to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. And I can't think of a program and a speaker that fits that mission better than Tex Sample. We were greatly surprised, there are many of us, by the recent election, and he's going to, I think, give us some insight. Dr. Sample is professor emeritus at the St. Paul School of Theology. He has published 13 books, including the bestseller U.S. Lifestyles and Mainline Churches. White Working Class Rage is his work in progress, dealing with the rationale for friction and time of Trump. So, without further ado, I'll hand it over to Tex.
Good morning. Let me say that it's always a delight to be here. I was trying to think. I think I've preached here about a half a dozen times, and I've been in the forum about a half a dozen times, but that's over 50 years. So, But I always have a good time here. I'm always delighted to be with you folks, and look forward to this time together, and especially to your comments and questions. I appreciate very much the very active participation you have in Moore Square, the Metro Organization for Racial and Economic Equity in the city. And appreciate your pastor, who's very much a presence there and works very directly with us. So appreciate you folks and appreciate what you do in the community. In 1968, George Wallace made a stump speech here in the Bottoms in Kansas City when he was running for president. A number of us from St. Paul and other places in the city decided we would go down and protest his speech. So we did what I try always to do when I'm in a protest or certainly a demonstration that might get ugly. I wore my suit and tie. And I want to know if they're beating me up. At least I was dressed for it, you know. We were handing out the one-page piece that I think John Swamley wrote, and some of you will remember John very well, I'm sure. And it was refuting Mr. Bush's, Mr. Bush. My God, that's Freudian. Mr. Wallace's stump speech. And people would see us. We were dressed up in our kind of nice clothes, and they'd say, well, isn't that nice? And they'd kind of smile at us, greet us, and take the piece of paper. Then they'd walk a few feet, and they'd begin to read it, and then they'd turn around, wad it up, and hit us with it. And I learned a long time ago, wadded up paper does not bother me. Rocks bother me, okay? Bullets bother me, but not paper. But, you know, as I watch those folks come into that meeting, it was clear to me, you know, The people coming to this meeting are my people. They're the people I was raised by. They're the people I was raised with. And the truth of the matter is, I don't know a thing about them, because academically, I have never studied white working class people in my life. Now, I had done a dissertation on Norman Thomas, a six-time socialist candidate for president. Of course, he had great interest in labor, as some of you may know. And I'd worked social ethics with a professor who was profoundly concerned about labor and those kinds of issues, but we'd never looked into what I might call the lifestyles of working class people. And that day during that demonstration, I went home and I said to myself, tomorrow I am going to the library and I'm going to find everything I can find on white working class people, and I'm going to read it, and I'm going to spend the rest of my life making that at least a piece of what I do in research and what I do academically. I think I've been faithful to that. What I want to do today is, I got a call about 6 or 8 months ago from Abingdon Press, which is our denominational press. United Methodist Press. And they asked me if I would do a book on the white working class, and particularly the rage that's going on there now. And I agreed to do it. And right now I'm in the throes and in the pain of getting that thing written. I write every minute. I'll probably spend half this afternoon writing and trying to get it done. What I want to share with you today is some of what I'm finding so far. And I've not finished the book, so there's more yet to come. You'll have to invite me back, I guess, or read the book, okay? But I want to spend some time talking with you about white working class rage. And I want you to know that I defend those folks. I'm on their side. That doesn't mean I agree with everything some of those folks say, but I'm on their side. That doesn't mean I'm against other folks. I'm certainly not against the very real and rightful claims of African Americans and Hispanics or Latinos and other people of color in our society. I take a very welcoming position in terms of homosexuality, have so since the late 60s. I'm learning about transgender, and I really want to support those folks and the rest. So, I mean, you know, I'm kind of a left-wing democratic socialist pacifist Christian, okay? So that's just kind of putting the ingredients of the brand on the bottle so you know what you're drinking. Some of you may say, I'm not consuming, I'm just listening. Let me start by saying this. I think the first thing about understanding white working class folks, and when I say that, I don't mean to exclude other people who are hurting, okay? It's just that that's my focus today. You understand? You can't talk about all those things at the same time. One of the things that we absolutely must have, I think, in this society is a coalition of people of color, black, white, brown, red, gold, and that if we're going to turn this society toward the public good, toward the common good, it's going to require that kind of alliance and that kind of working together. All right, so let me just say that at the onset. If you want to know how I connect with some of those other things, the book will have an entire chapter on racism, okay? So I don't want to duck some of those things. But I think it might be useful to start by looking first at just the context that we're dealing with. And when I say context, I mean what's going on in terms of big picture stuff, if you will, in this society. For one thing, I like what President H.W. Bush talked about as voodoo economics. I mean, I like his description. It's a kind of a free market fundamentalism, but not really. It claims free market. Who was it that said that? Was it Joe Badgett? No. He said that what we've got in this country is socialism at the top and raw market forces at the bottom. I think that's exactly right. Joseph Stiglitz, who's one of my favorite economists, he said that there are reasons why we can't see the invisible hands. Sometimes it's not there. All right. We've got concentration in the market. We've got privatization, deregulation, lower taxes, lower wages, free trade agreements, not fair trade agreements, union busting, defunding public services, downsizing, offshoring, price gouging, Citizens United, the Wall Street bailout, student debt, tax dodging, criminalization of poverty, and militarization of police. That's a short list of what we've got going on right now. Look at productivity and wages with me for a minute. From after World War I to the mid-70s, productivity in this country rose 103%. And wages kept pace. In fact, they were a fraction of one percentage point better. Wages rose 103%+. From the mid-70s to today, notice this figure. Productivity rose 68%, while wages were flat for most workers. Let me just say to you, if you're not angry, you don't have to identify that stat. You don't have to know that dynamic to be angry, huh? Because you are getting nailed in the process. C. Wright Mills used to say, we need to read statistics with compassion. When you read that statistic with compassion, I would urge you to ask the question, what is going on with working class people? Do I need to keep saying this? Let me say it for sure so you know I know. And African Americans, Latinos are doing worse. If you aren't angry, dear God, then these kinds of demonic forces have made you numb. They've made you numb. Look at this one. If the minimum wage had risen with productivity, it would be nearly $19 an hour. That's a finding of the Economic Policy Institute. I'd recommend that you go online and look them up. It's a very good outfit. I think they do quite good research. Look at Thomas Frank and what he said. By the way, I disagree with his book about Kansas. He didn't quite get it. I'll take him on a little bit in the book. But he quoted a statistic when he spoke at the library downtown just recently, what, 3-4 months ago? He said this, from 1930 to 1980, 90% of the population took home 70% of the income. 90% got 70% of the income. From 1980 to the present, 90% pocketed none of the growth. The growth. I'm interested, too, in what I call wealthfare, corporate welfare. Do you remember when Mr. Reagan talked about the welfare queens? Now, that lady did, apparently. She was convicted. Made off with about $8,000 she should not have according to the law. Now, if you put that in theological and ethical terms, that's another question. But she should have not have had it according to the law. And let me be bipartisan here. And when I talk about Mr. Reagan, I have to talk about Bill Clinton, because he's the one who, along with the Speaker of the House, did what they call welfare reform. I'm in a church where two-thirds of the people are homeless. And those people started showing up on the streets during the Reagan administration. And what Clinton did has exacerbated that. So if you think somehow, in my book, I call the Republicans the Dems. I'm sorry, I call the Democrats the Dems, D-I-M-S, because they don't have a clue about what's going on with working class people. Or at least they don't have a clue in terms of what you do about it. And I call the Republicans the Repugs, R-E-P-U-G-S, because of the towering immorality of the positions of their social policies in this country. Okay? So I think you will find I am not happy with either party. All right? I am happy with some of the people in some of each party, actually. But it seems to me that people of faith have to be people who care about the common good. And we do not have a society now that gives a damn about the common good. And a Congress that's bought off. What we've got there are gigolos and prostitutes to corporate power and power elites. Can you tell I have feelings? David K. Johnston, who is a wonderful Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, he did a book called Free Lunch. It's a 2007 book, so these data that I'll show you right here are a bit old, but I'll come to some more recent data. Look at Cabela's. We have one out here east of town. He found that at least 20 communities have agreed to subsidize Cabela's stores or distribution centers to the tune of more than $500 million. One study found that Walmart received $1.2 billion in known subsidies that were spread out over several hundred facilities. But then he reports another study that suggests they actually received $14 billion subsidies. I call that wealth fair. Let's move more recently. The Oxfam study, by the way, you can find Oxfam, just put Oxfam on your computer and here it comes, okay? Each dollar America's 50 biggest companies paid in federal taxes between 2008 and 2014, they received $27 back in federal loans, loan guarantees, and bailouts. For each dollar they paid in taxes, they got 27 back. Now, they paid back, as far as we know, some of those loans. What about all this other stuff? And every time we start talking about welfare for people who are poor, you will hear the think tanks and some of these corporate executives, not all, because there are some decent corporate executives in this country, okay? I'm aware of that. But you will hear some of these folks decrying the dependency of these folks on federal money. And I'll tell you, some of those very people are lying through their teeth. I'm very interested in the research of Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page. Page didn't quite make it. Oh, no, not quite. Page. These guys come from unaccredited schools, one from Princeton and one from Northwestern. They studied 1,779 policy issues. Folks, that's a lot of work. I'm not going to do all their conclusions, but if you go online, you can find it. They say that the preferences of the average American, those preferences receive a minuscule, or those persons have a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. 1,779 studies. The net alignments of the most influential business-oriented groups. The net alignments of the most influential business-oriented groups are negatively related to the average citizen's wishes. It goes on. The preferences of economic elites have far more independent impact upon policy change than the preferences of average citizens do. And then this, in America, the majority does not rule, at least not in the sense of actually determining policy. Do you ever hear things like government of the people, by the people, for the people? You know, I'm kind of screwy. I actually believe in that. I wonder sometimes if everybody does. Who are the people who are really subversive in this country? Now, I've been studying some ethnographic, sociological, anthropological studies of white working class people. Now, let me say a couple of things about class. Class is just about the most fluid concept you can study. And you're going to find all kinds of ways of approaching class. Today it's popular with the pollsters to say that working class is anybody in the country without a four-year college degree. Well, that can be helpful, but it's not really a very good definition of class. And I report that in the book, but I find what's more helpful are these folks who go on the scene, who live in these communities for a period of time, and do that kind of ethnographic or sociological study of a working class community, okay? What I want to do is share with you what some people are finding. So let me put it this way. I've tried to say that there are some very real things going on in the context of our national life that are powerfully damaging the white working class and others in our society. And I'm saying, when you find rage there, can I ask the question, why would you not? Why would you not? Can that rage be misplaced? Of course. Is it sometimes detrimental to the lives of white working class people? Yes. But may I ask you not to put all those folks in one box? Because what I discover the more I study is how complex, how diverse the white working class is. And I hope to just illustrate that by what we're going to do here. I love the work of Michelle Lamont. Now, hers was an international study. She studied the U.S. and she studied France, working class men in her work. And these come from her study of working class men in suburban Newark, New Jersey. What is so interesting to me about Lamont's work is how central morality was in the thinking of those men. That when those men talked about their lives, their situation, over and over again, moral themes came up. Well, what kind? One thing about the morality was a sense of what it was to be a good person. To be a good person for them was to be a hard worker. It was to be responsible. It was to take care of your family. It was to protect your family. Hear that? And the profound morality around those kind of convictions that characterize her meetings with, her conversations with those men, very, very clear. Now, hang on to that, because that's going to continue to show up in nuanced and different forms, but we'll look at it. All right. These were not poor white men. These were men who had jobs. They had reasonably good incomes. They described themselves as lower middle class. They did not use the word class. That's an interesting point, too. The other thing is, she said that what people do with morality in terms of her study is that they make distinctions. They make distinctions about, who's us and who's them. They make distinctions about who's in and who's out. For example, they tended to describe themselves as the disciplined self. Now, they often would not characterize black men that way. And they would sometimes make a moral distinction between themselves as disciplined, hardworking. And they would see blacks and the poor, not all blacks, but blacks and the poor, as lazy or indolent. Okay? So you do get that kind of distinction going on among these very men. So what that does is set up what she describes as symbolic boundaries. But her point is, how do those symbolic boundaries then become actual social boundaries? In other words, how long do you do something like that it does not then become something hardened into the kind of social boundary that really restricts people? So there's an issue there, and it has to be addressed, okay? Let me go on. Can you tell I'm rushing? All right. Then she talks about this. She says, what I find in those men is a kind of a mindset that she calls cultural repertoires. What she means by that is that they have cultural ingredients kind of in a repertoire that they have by which they interpret the world and understand things going on. And she says these, as she calls them repertoires. Man, you can't get away with calling it repertoires with most working class white guys. I know. You better come up with another word. So I've used words like storehouse, storage bin. The one I really like is barrel. So it's a barrel of resources, cultural resources, if you will. One of them has to do with, I use narratives here, and I'm tending to categorize narratives as kind of national narratives. Some of these men operate out of a notion of manifest destiny or American exceptionalism, all right? You know, those kinds of ideas. Our American Republican thought, I mean that in the sense of the thought about the state, not the particular party in this case, okay? So they have narratives like that. They may not have those down the way that an academic would want you to be able to list the 8 or 10 important ingredients in an exam, But those are narratives that form and shape how they respond to life. She says, secondly, they're images. For example, one of the things that some people try to do is put images into our minds that become controlling when we think about certain kinds of issues. Welfare queen would be an image, for example. But there are some other possibilities. She also found some anti-racist rhetoric where people would oppose racism. Those kinds of images or those kinds of ideas are perhaps proverbs. You know, I don't know about you. I was raised in a working class home at least the first 11 years of my life. We made it into the lower middle class through my dad's working in a sheet metal operator in New Orleans on war vessels. And then he bought a small cab company. So I was raised in the cab stand, if you will. But proverbs were just basic to the way we interpreted life. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. The good is the enemy of the best, you know. We had an old boy who came home from the war shot in the gluteus maximus. That was no problem. You could get hit anywhere in war. But all he did was brag about all the heroic things he did, as he said, under fire. Well, we got tired of it, sick and tired of it. And so one day my dad, who was a wonderful proverbialist, put it in a proverb, and it went like this: son, don't you ever come home from the war bragging like you won the Medal of Honor when you've been shot in the ass. Well, you hear what I'm talking about, kind of the way in which proverbs and the rest. The whole role of vocabulary. How important vocabulary is. What kind of words? Most of the people in this room, in my experience, are progressive liberal types. Can I say to you that there is a whole host of words we use that turn those folks off? I'll come back to that later. We turn them off. We got to learn to clean up our mouths, in a sense, all right? Categories. What categories do they use to interpret the world? Lamont discovered that neoliberalism, which I regard as enemy, that neoliberalism has become very much a part of the language and the thought of the men she studied. You know, so let me go on. Jennifer Sherman, this is another study. She studied Golden Valley. Now, that's a fictitious name to a city in Northern California. And in Golden Valley, that was a town that had existed on the basis of a lumber industry. And the lumber industry collapsed for a number of reasons I can't go into right now. She found in Golden Valley, I've got to remember to click yours as well as mine. I'm going to close this. She found again herself that morality was a central concern. In fact, she says that morality in Golden Valley is a social force that actually helps to construct the social order of that town. Right? She says, secondly, she finds a plethora of these cultural ingredients, this repertoire that Lamont was talking about. She refers to Lamont in her work. And she says, now, she said, I didn't find any anti-black comments in Golden Valley. I find that very interesting. She said, for one thing, there weren't any people of color there, at least not very many. And there were so few competing cultural resources, so you didn't have those kind of racist comments. She said, but remember, these cultural resources, let me put it this way, this barrel of resources was not coherent. It was a conglomeration of ideas, and it was highly malleable. Now, what I want to point to is this. In terms of that morality, she did not say the morality was compensative. You know how some people would say, well, that's just you're compensating with morality for some real stuff you ain't got, okay? She said, no, that's not what's going on. What she found out with this morality was that it was actively helping people deal with a very difficult, hard, financial, economic situation in their lives. Am I communicating that? That it actually was adaptive, not compensative. A second thing that she found was that morality was transformative, that actually they could use traditional moralities to make significant changes. For example, a lot of the men in that community had lost their lumber jobs, which were good paying, and now they were working for like $9 and $10 an hour and could not find a good job. What happened is that a number of those men, talking things like family values, talking family tradition, in other words, talking out of the morality they held, it was possible for women to go into the workforce. And those women did go into those workforces. These men became better fathers. They took more of a role in household chores. They did more in terms of the raising of the children. What in this case Sherman says is that these men took on feminist values without calling them that, and began to make the kind of changes desperately needed in order to cope and survive in the hard economic circumstances they were dealing with. Now, one learning from that, if I don't get a chance to talk about it, I will talk about it in the book. Aristotle said that rhetoric is learning how to use the available forms of persuasion in a time and place. The available forms of persuasion. What I'm trying to say is that we need people who are working with white working class folks and others who know how to use the forms of persuasion that are active, relevant in the lives of the people you want to work with. In other words, you cannot go in there imposing a point of view. You can't go in there imposing a kind of a rhetoric. You can't go in there talking a lingo. I have a relative. They have two friends. They're teachers. My relative says, you know what I can't stand about them? First of all, they have an idea about everything. And secondly, they're going to tell you everything they know. And you know what? Actually, I think I probably agree with her friends, but I would to God they would get their damn rhetoric straight. Do you understand what I'm saying? See, I think they could talk to my sister if they would learn something. Am I communicating my concern here? And not call working people by names. Do you know that redneck is the only racial slur you can get away with in this culture today? And I hear progressives and liberals use it all the time, and I'm gonna speak theologically here. It's a goddamned mistake. Dealing with hardship and loss, they found morality adaptive and transformative, which means morality in that barrel of resources is a major resource for social change that I think a lot of people haven't examined. Also, uses of morality in terms of tradition. A lot of people have this idea that tradition is some lock-stepped conformity across time that never changes. Well, first of all, none of us operates apart from a tradition. We're all operating in traditions. Nobody's free of it. I love Alasdair MacIntyre's wonderful comment that a tradition is a socially located, historically extended, means it goes across time. It's a socially located, historically extended argument. Argument. Isn't that wonderful? And what tradition becomes in these families that Sherman studied, tradition was in a sense an argument, and in some cases a very adaptive and transformative argument. All right. And I want to say this. I love the story about the farmer who had an axe in the family that had been in the family for four generations. You know the story. Yeah. He said it's had six handles, and it's had four axe heads, but it's the same axe. All right. Now, I want to say something to you. That's the way traditions are. And I'm going to say to you, you Unitarians and Universalists, whom you know I respect and love, you look at your tradition and look at how many axe heads you've had and handles you've had, and I'm glad of it, and I suspect most of you are, to the extent you've had opportunity to study that stuff. Okay? So pay attention to tradition. They also found that family logics are so crucial in this that they don't, White working class people do not ask what the National Organization of Women thinks. They do not ask what NAACP thinks. They don't even ask what the KKK thinks, I'll have you know. What they do is when they address an issue, they address it in terms of what happens to my family. What happens to my job? What happens to my kids? What about my kinfolks? And they tend to live in extended families, more than we do, certainly. All right? They did not fly off to Boston or drive off to Boston and go to school and get lost from home the rest of their lives, okay? It's that kind of thing. Let me see if right here. I got to hold on that. Let me do this just for a piece. Well, I got to do that later. Here, I got to hurry. I'm skipping things, okay? Now then, there's Catherine Kramer. She does a book called The Politics of Resistance, and it's a study of Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin. And she, during her study, which went about 5 years, the Scott Walker run for governor came just after the middle of her study, as I recall. And she says this. She says one of the things, her study was a study of class. She wanted to study the effect of class on consciousness. And what she discovered is that you can't simply tell what somebody's consciousness is going to be on the basis of their class. Because, quite frankly, there are a lot of other factors that intervene. One is identity, and that's a powerful, powerful notion in all three of these. I've waited here to talk about it simply because I can't talk about all those things at once. But she says identity and class are powerfully intertwined. One economist, whose name escapes me right now, said that in hard times, people don't vote their interests. They vote their identities. Hear that. They don't vote their interests. They vote their identities. Now, there's a lot I want to say about the way the word interest has been, how interest has been used across the centuries. And that's complex enough, but we'll do that another time. She also says these people are not partisan. She said they held the views they held not because they were Republicans or Democrats. They were conservatives. They held their views because they were conservative. But the primary thing for her, for them, she found, was that they had a deep sense of distributive injustice, that they were the victims of a lot of injustice in rural and small town Wisconsin. Let's look at that. She describes what she calls rural consciousness. And what she found that pervasively in all the people that she worked with, all the groups. She worked with 39 groups. Now, they were not all rural. Some of them were, you know, Milwaukee and Madison. But in all of the other 39 groups, she found this rural consciousness, and it's made up of three ingredients. They felt that they had sharply unequal power and that they did not participate actively in the decision-making of the state. Secondly, they felt that they had real differences in lifestyle from the people, especially in Madison and Milwaukee, and that they were disrespected by those people. And thirdly, that they got an unequal share of the public resources. In other words, they paid taxes, but they didn't get the money back that they paid, which turns out not to be quite true, as we'll see. Now, this rural consciousness fill these folks with resentment. They resented the cities whom they thought were advantaged. They resented government spending and taxes. They thought they were overtaxed and not getting their share, as I said. She did not find a single racist comment in a single small town or rural group in the entirety of her study, which covered 5 years. Not a single one. Now, that doesn't mean it's not there, but she didn't hear one. She spent a lot of time with these folks. Who did they resent? They resented the public employees of the state whom they felt received too much pay. They resented the University of Wisconsin at Madison because those folks didn't pay attention to them, and they also received too much pay. And they resented professors. Oh, my. I love what one of them said. She said, you know what's wrong with professors? They take showers before they go to work. They take showers before they go to work. So you hear the kind of resentment. Now let's look at a couple of those things. As a fact of the matter is, they pay less taxes and they get more than they pay. But that's not quite enough of a comment. Secondly, they have a lot lower wages and they have fewer resources in rural America, and it's getting worse. I've not driven through rural Missouri the way I want to and the way I will here before long. But Peggy and I took a trip through western Kansas down into northeast New Mexico this summer. And I'm going to tell you, you get out there and you drive through those rural towns of Kansas, and the economic hardship is there in architectural starkness. Closed stores, closed shops. Now, there's some doing well. There's oil. Some have big cattle operations. You can see them. You can see the wealth in those communities. But you look at rural America, and those folks have had a hard time. There's about a six-page section in Kramer's book where she lays out what's going on in rural America. And it's the best statement in that brief a form that I've read. If I ever again teach a course on rural America, every student in that class will read that or I'll flunk them. Okay? They're going to have to read those six pages. So she said the other thing is a lot of people, they have different needs and they have less capacity to pay. But also she asks an important question. She says, well, she makes an assertion, that money is not being well spent in rural America. Who's getting the money? What's it going for? Who's really asking the working people of rural America where that money needs to be spent? Point is, there's some directions there. I got 3 minutes. Let me say this. One other thing about Kramer. She said those people define the haves not by wealth, but by culture. By culture. They feel their way of life is under attack. I'm going to go past Russell Hochschild, Arlie Hochschild's work, Strangers in Their Own Land, a study of Tea Partiers in Louisiana. Powerful study. What to do? First thing we've got to do, we've got to start listening to white working class folks and others and not condemn them. That means learning how they think and talk. Joe Badgett wrote a great book, Deer Hunting with Jesus. He's a working class guy. He is brilliant. I don't know anybody who can move from a personal pain to a social structural domination as rapidly. He can do it in a sentence. He's just amazing. But he said this, and it helped me in terms of my own listening. I've wondered about cussing for years. For years. I've been attracted to it academically and personally. I say to people, I don't smoke, drink, chew. I cuss a little, all right? Maybe I cuss a lot. But what Badgett said was, we, talking about he and white working class, he is that. He says, we use cussing for punctuation. I had never thought that thought before. It's that kind of complexity when you get into the lingo that people need to learn, we need to learn, I need to learn and appreciate. It means respect. We've got to show respect for folks. And to tell you the truth, we don't. You ought to hear the list of names. Read Elizabeth Eisenberg's wonderful book, White Trash. She collects the names that we have called working people across the history of this country. It's only a selective list. It goes on for a paragraph. Lubbers, clay eaters, of course, white trash, and others. We need an indigenous approach to social change, one that will work with the repertoire of cultural resources. I mean by that barrel of ideas, stories, images, proverbs, categories, vocabularies. That means, first of all, learning how those work. Which idea or story trumps, another story, or idea or proverb? In what context do some of those work and don't, and so forth? So how do you learn to work with and among those kinds of resources? Identity is so clear, and coming to respect that issue and how wedded morality is to identity and to worth. And work with distinctions. I remember Jeff Stout in his book, and I'm almost done. Jeff Stout in his wonderful book on Blessed the Organizers, he said, you know what we really need to do in this country is we need to organize the people of this country against the forces that are dominating our lives. He says we all have common interest there. I think he's right. So a shifting of them and us, if you will. Finally, I'm going to work on a working class theology, and I can't do that now. and the big one at the end is organize. Do we have some other questions?
Yes. So now we're going to let Tex call on people with questions.
Comment or question? Yes, ma'am.
Why can a man who is a billionaire hit so hard with the people who have nothing or barely nothing?
Yeah. All right, thank you. That's an important question. Let me say two or three things. The best research I've seen, it's only come out in the last 10 days, is some research that suggests that the support for Mr. Trump, I think you're talking about, support for Mr. Trump basically looks pretty much like a Republican vote. It looks like a Republican vote. Republicans voted for him in about the numbers they normally would. Second thing to be said is there are some people who really did vote for Mr. Trump who had not been voting in that direction before. Interestingly enough, some of the people who voted for Mr. Trump voted for Mr. Obama both times. But I'm going to tell you, I'll be honest, I voted for Obama both times, but I was disappointed. The man turned out to be a moderate, and he did not stand up for working people. Black or white or brown or gold in this country. I know he did a few things, and I know he had the opposition of a Republican Party that tried to stop anything that he did. But I'm not happy with Mr. Obama. So I think what you've got is a Democratic Party that has not been responsive to a basic group that's been constitutive of that party in the past. And I think part of that reaction, it's a populism. We had populism both ways. We had populism in the direction of Mr. Trump, populism in the direction of Mr. Sanders. And so that's reaction. That's resentment. That's anger. That's rage. And it went both ways. The other thing, too, is white working class people resent upper middle class business and professionals because of those are the people they have contact with. And they see what they do to them. They don't have that kind of resentment toward millionaires, the rich, because these studies tend to show that they think those people is working hard and deserving what they've got. That's where I think we need to get into that barrel of resources and raise some real questions about finance capitalism. That's too quick, but that's a good question. Thank you, ma'am. Yes, sir.
So this is related. I absolutely agree with you that the white working class has legitimate reasons to be enraged. But I'd like your thoughts on why in last year's presidential nominating process, most of the white working class chose not to align themselves with Bernie Sanders and his policy proposals that actually would benefit them, and instead align themselves with a billionaire who had a long and storied history of racist statements and behavior and misogyny and leeching off of the government to make money, had no actual policy proposals on the table. Why would you say they align themselves with Mr. Trump instead of Mr. Sanders?
Okay, now remember that when we talk about white working class folks, you got to talk about some who align themselves with Mr. Trump, certainly not all. I don't even think most. There's no question that in some places like Wisconsin, for example, they tipped the election in the direction of Mr. Trump. I don't think it's any question. I think that went on. It didn't help any that that Mrs. Clinton called them deplorables. So there were some real gaffes by some people. We know some of the other things going on. Secondly, what we typically assume is that their self-interest is aligned with certain kinds of policies and so forth that people in other political positions would bring about, like Democrats, as an example. I don't know about you, I'm pretty disappointed with what the Democrats have done when they've been in power. And I don't find them all that terrific, quite frankly. By the way, I did vote for Mr. Sanders the first time. When you had that vote, he didn't have that option the second time. I mean, he wasn't on the ballot. But I think these folks vote identity, not interest. They vote culture, not what advantage. And I think, quite frankly, they'd gotten tired of the Democratic Party making promises they didn't fulfill. And you see, you got a problem of belief here. Democrats may say they're going to do all this, but do they do it? You know, Mr. Obama had the control of the House and the Senate on the health care. Why did we not take the public option, which would have been far better for working class people, far better? They didn't do it. Why did they not do it? Guess. Health care corporations, big health insurance companies. What I'm trying to say is that I hear, you do know in my heart of hearts, I wish working class folks would come out here and vote all kinds of policies, and I suspect some of those you and I would agree on wholeheartedly. I'm saying is their experience has been voting for those folks hasn't paid off. Now, what Trump was, what they like about, there's a style question with Trump. He tells it like it is. He doesn't do the kind of namby-pamby kind of language that politicians do. Now, quite frankly, I think some of Mr. Trump's language is outrageous. Okay? But what I'm saying is the way he talks, who does that sound like? Does that sound like a Harvard-trained politician? Or does that sound a little more like the guy down on the dock? You hear what I'm saying? I'm just saying right now, culture is a big deal. I'm powerfully formed by Karl Marx. Now, I've read enough of him, I think I know where he's wrong, so don't misunderstand me. But Marx's notion of class consciousness, pursuing its interests, being a class that knows what its interest is and follows it, that kind of direct attention to their interests. Boy, I'll tell you, in my reading, in my research, my work, that ain't very typical. You know, in other words, we've got to get into the logics of how people actually think. And we work with them on the basis of how we think they ought to think, okay? So I mean that as a friendly response. I hope you'll take it that way. Yeah. Yes, sir.
So let me follow up on that. I like your reference to indigenous sensibility. I get around to a lot of different groups.
Yeah.
And I think that the phenomenon that we have these cultures and the cultures reinforce sets of ideas that we call morality is a significant one. But there's three terms that I would be curious as to how you see them being related. One is identity, and one is this idea of indigenous. But the third one is indignation, because what I find common and identity and indignation have become equivalent in this country. We are so wrapped around the idea that our personal opinion is so powerful that we are entitled to lead with our indignation. So I'm wondering how that might fit into your thinking. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I think your naming of indignation is a very powerful piece of this picture. I'm very much committed to community organizing. Some of you in here participate with me in that and know that. One of the things that I love about organizing is the way it stresses cool anger. In other words, if it's hot anger, it won't be used to do the kind of organizing work that needs to be done. You'll just blow off steam, or sometimes that takes other, even violent forms, you know. But what I would love to see is to see the kind of indignation that's going on in this country among certainly the folks we've been talking about and people of color, women, the rest. That I'd love to see that transform into a cool anger that knows how to organize, that knows how to do referenda at the state level and let the people of this state vote on the minimum wage. Let the people of this state vote on right to work in some of these issues. So, you know, I agree that indignation and I agree, and when it's just wild, thrashing out anger. Well, let me report one piece of research on that. And I can't name that right now. I could find it. They said that policy officials tend to change when there is disruptive, violent protests from people more than when there is highly organized effort by people. So that I'm a pacifist, but that comment always troubles me. I still have the confidence that organized people can beat organized money. And there's never been a time when we needed that more than we do in this country today. So turning that indignation into cool anger would be my hope.
Last real quick question.
Yeah.
Yeah. The question is, given that all the anger has been unleashed in the last 2 years, what do you think is going to happen come next year when all these people that still don't have a job and are still poor that Mr. Trump addressed, what do you think they're going to do? Because that anger is still there.
Oh, that anger is there. Two things. One is that I hope Mr. Trump is not impeached before the midterm elections. All right. I don't want him impeached before that time. That's the first thing. The second is that I don't see the situation of folks. I know we saw some recent figures about, you know, employment being up. Employment had gone up in the closing months, year of Mr. Obama's presidency, and he did do some good things, you know, around some things. And we've seen that continue with Trump's time in the presidency. My concern is that those jobs are not paying well and that we've still got this flat line. And that's not a bad metaphor, this flat line for wages in this country with only slight improvement. I worry that indignation could become abject futility. That's my concern. I hope that there is enough anger to begin to make some of the changes we really do need to make.
That was really great, Tex. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, White Working Class Rage, with Dr. Tex Sample. This program was recorded on Sunday, September 22nd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcast and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.